And welcome to the Slongcast, episode 12 for Monday, August 2nd, 2010. I'm your host, Kevin Slonka, and with me today, as usual, Ryan Lancey.
Hey, how's everyone doing?
So we have, somebody's got a drink.
That's a can of Pepsi throwback.
Too bad we didn't hear the fizz. I was really looking forward to that. That's good. So we got a lot of interesting stuff to talk about this week. Some weird things out there, some throwbacks to some stories we did a couple weeks ago. And as usual, mobile phones. A lot going on in the mobile phone world. But before we get into that, we want to start off with a weird story from Google about a patent that Google has. And the patent is to monitor your cursor movements. So it looks like what they're trying to do. Now, this patent was filed in 2005. It's a continuation from a patent in 2004. So Google obviously has been, you know, writing code and trying to do this since 2004. But just recently, everything has been approved. They want to track where your mouse goes while you're using Google. Not what you click on. They can already track that. But they just want to see, like, where you hover your mouse. So probably going to be a lot of JavaScript in the browser detecting where your mouse is. Do you find this necessary? Can you think of what they're going to use this for?
Well, I mean, it makes sense to me to do this, like, from a data gathering point of view. Because a lot of times when I go to Google, you know, I read the link that comes up in the search results and maybe some of the summary. And something I've often been surprised that Google hasn't done is sort of like create a pop-up on mouse over with like more detail.
Doesn't Bing do that?
I think Bing does for some things, yeah. Maybe not all things.
I know some search engine does that.
Yeah, so I think that that could actually be pretty useful. But in doing that, detecting that mouse over, you know, they probably would gather information based on how long you read it. But if they gave you more information, maybe they could even... You know, if that pop-up came up, they could say, oh, well, he really read this one, or she really read that one.
Right, yeah. It definitely shows, you know, what you're reading, because a lot of times you can get the information you're looking for from that little summary. So right. you don't even have to click on the link. I know there's sometimes I'll go to Google and just search for something, and bam, it's in the summary of the first three results, and I close the tab. I'm done. Mm-hmm. You know, but they don't know that. They don't know that I got what I wanted, but now with this, I mean, invasion of privacy? I don't see it. Do you?
No, I don't. I mean, they track what you click on, and I don't see why they can't track what people pay a little more attention to compared to other things. I think it's fine. On another aspect to this article that I found interesting is that they were granted a patent for this. Not that they're just going to do it, but the patent. And there's always long been a discussion about software patents. I think this is a perfect example of a proper software patent. It's about using different ideas to collectively create a system that does something else, rather than patenting source code.
Right. Unlike all the patents that we talked about in previous weeks that are total crap.
Right. Yeah. I like this patent. I think this is maybe something that could be used as an example of how to allocate patents properly. I guess kudos to the PTO on that.
Yeah, whoever is granting patents, good job on this one, bad job on everything else.
Yeah, exactly.
So, whether you knew it or not, last week, the end of last week and into the weekend was a very interesting conference to me and probably to other people, is Black Hat and DEF CON. And Black Hat and DEF CON, they're security-minded conferences. Black Hat's more of a training, here's some, you know, security things we've been learning, whereas DEF CON is more of, here's a bunch of hackers together, we're going to show you the real detailed stuff, we're going to break things. Really cool conferences, really cool stuff going on. We have a bunch of stories this week coming out of Black Hat. This is the first one, which I thought was really interesting, because we talked about ATMs for a couple weeks, you know, in the past, and how they can be hacked, how they can have the skimmers put on them, and how people have, you know, been able to modify the source code to tamper with it. Well, this guy actually, Barnaby Jack, demonstrated it at Black Hat. This was a completely different one from the different hack from what we talked about before. Basically, he found out that all of these ATMs, we're not talking about ATMs at a bank. We're talking about standalone ATMs that you might see in the mall or somewhere else. They need some way to transmit information so they know how much money you have, whether you can take out money. They need to credit or debit your account, whatever you do. And that's always done via telephone line. Mm-hmm. So this guy found out that, well, the operating system that these things have, you can pretty much dial into it from the telephone line, and he found out how to break it, and he was able to make the ATM, you know, give out money, play music, do all kinds of crap. I mean, it was ridiculous.
I think this is awesome. If my ATM played some music when I went to take money out,
seriously,
I'd
like
love it.
Money bag sounds or
yeah,
you
money,
know, coins.
Money.
I'm looking for the Super Mario coin. That's what I want.
Oh, that'd be good.
Yeah, so he demonstrated it, which basically means that anybody who went to that conference now knows how to do this. Because, you know, that's what happens at these conferences. Not only do they demonstrate it, but they show you how they did it and probably give out the source code. But luckily, he told the ATM vendors, and a bunch of the ones that are vulnerable came up with fixes and are in the process of applying them. But that's still, you know, it's still kind of scary. Mm-hmm. That, you know, every week we see another ATM breaking story, you know, and these are the things we all use, you know, probably once, at least once a month, you know, probably go to the ATM.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm a little weary. I really can't tell you what to do with this. You know, you can't beware of this.
Well, you could avoid these brands, these particular brands of ATMs. I guess they listed, was it Triton and. They've got and in there twice. That's funny. Hello, Mr. Editor. Where are you? It's Triton and Tranax is the other one.
Yeah, Tranax.
So, but.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, definitely if you can see the brand of it, stay away. But I would suggest just staying away from these remote ATMs anyways.
Yeah.
You know, like stop at a bank before you go to the mall. Don't go to
that or, you know, just do the cash back. At, like go to Walmart, buy a 25-cent pack of gum or whatever they cost now.
Yeah, whatever.
You know, and get $20 cash back.
Yeah, and even so, I mean.
No fee.
That is, you know, that's something to think about too because all of these stores that do that, they need an internet connection to do the same thing. So.
They do. I'm guessing that it's sort of more like the bank. I mean, the bank has an internet connection. The ATMs and machines inside the store that aren't remote like ATMs are probably integrated into their like accounting software in the store. So it's probably pretty, at least somewhat harder to hack.
Right, right.
I would hope.
Yeah, we would hope. So yeah, definitely at least be aware of what ATMs you're using. You know, Tranax and Triton or Trition. I don't know. Probably Triton. Because I'm an idiot and can't pronounce
words.
Don't
use any ones that say Sri Lanka.
Yes, dude. Actually, please use those. Those are the best ATM software. That was a very bad sentence. Just use them.
Use them, yes. No, wait, don't.
So keeping up with security, we talked about before a big Microsoft vulnerability that targets SCADA systems, which is basically the software that you'll see running things like power grids and nuclear power plants. All of these software products that were never meant to be connected to the internet, and it was a problem with Microsoft Shortcut, the .lnk, and the way the operating system handles that. Basically, Microsoft has come out with a patch for it. Finally, I mean, this isn't really a big thing to look at. You know, it's not really awesome that they came out with this, but I thought it was awesome because, you know, really big problems that this thing can cause, and they came out with it out of cycle. So, I mean, we're obviously not going to talk about every time Microsoft issues a patch, but I thought this one was pretty important due to what it affects.
Yeah, if we talked about it every time, we'd never stop talking.
Yeah, that's all the show would be about.
Yeah, exactly.
But I did just want to mention that if you were scared about, you know, the world being hacked because of these problems, they did issue a patch.
Microsoft to the rescue.
Yay! Go Bill Gates. All right, so... Next thing, still from not from Black Hat, but from DEF CON. This was a really cool thing and kind of scary if you're a member of the FBI. Basically, like I said before, DEF CON is the conference where all of the hardcore hackers go. And they were going to have a contest this year, a social engineering contest. And what they were doing, they were going to give people a set amount of time to research certain big name, very prominent companies. They had a list that you could choose from. Figure out any information you can figure out from the internet. And then they would give you something like 20 to 30 minutes on the phone. And your job in this contest was to call and see how much information you can get out of them and what type of information to see if you can actually social engineer these huge companies into giving out money. Giving out information.
I wish they would give out money. That would be much better.
I'm still thinking of the ATMs with the money.
Yeah.
But have you heard of this contest, or
is the contest called Hack the Human? No, I'm just kidding.
I don't think, but that would be a really good name.
Yeah, Hack the Human. I don't know. I mean, I from what I read in the article, they got nervous, but then they're like, "Oh, okay, it's not a big deal."
Yeah, I think the only reason that they backed off is because they weren't going after like banks or hospitals. There were a certain set of
just tech companies.
Yeah, a certain set of genres, I guess, if you can say, of companies that they weren't going after.
Yeah, not financial companies or medical companies. Just the software companies that write the bank software and the medical
right.
software. Nothing to worry about here.
Nothing to see here. Move
Thank
along.
Thank you, FBI.
And I think that was kind of weird because, I mean, yeah, maybe you don't want to do this in a public setting so that everybody can see how vulnerable banks and hospitals are. But on the other hand, I kind of wish they did go after them because then we would see how vulnerable banks and hospitals are and they would finally know to fix it. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think it's a really cool thing. I just wish they would have went after everybody and not just tech companies. So this next story here, Ryan, you submitted this.
Yeah, this is pretty cool. I've been following little developments in the fiber optic computing, segment for a long time. Like when I see an article, it interests me because, we hit these limits on every or brick walls or whatever you want to call them, hurdles every year to 2 years with regular copper based processors or metal, electronic processors that, you hit some kind of wall you have to overcome. So the one of the next forefronts is fiber optic CPUs. So Intel has this new CPU. Well, it's actually a chip, and it can process data at something like 50 gigabits per second. And they said this would be the equivalent of downloading an entire 720p movie in 1 second.
Yeah, that's pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, it's impressive. They're saying that it's a small leap, and it's the research probably won't be directly brought to market, but will probably be used in the future, for newer CPUs.
So they're saying that this is about a processor, a chip that they're looking to make into a processor at some time. How does this work in terms of heat? Like, does it produce heat? Is this glass, the glass going to melt with this amount of heat that normal processors put off, or is that heat not present?
I think they probably, I don't know. My guess is that there would be more efficiency. Obviously the reason a processor gets hot is, if you know anything about transistors, is that there's a voltage that the transistor has, and then there's an input to it. And the difference in voltage between the power supply, basically, and the output voltage creates heat during its while it's switching off and on. And that's what creates heat in a transistor, okay? For anyone who's not, an EE. Neither am I, but I just know that aspect of...
Because you're smart.
Well, yeah, I try. Anyway. But I don't know what a fiber optic transistor would do. I guess it would have some reference, light intensity. I don't even know how they define voltage and light.
Right. Maybe it's just, different measurements of the spectrum, what color, quote unquote, color the light is.
I have no idea. I mean, it could just be intensity. It could be phase. There'd be a zillion things, but, my guess is that it'd probably be more efficient.
Yeah. So probably not much heat at all.
Yeah. To figure, like, modern processors, they have like thermal design power of like 125 watts or something like that. It's, the bigger ones, I've heard, I've read this other places, and I don't know that I've ever confirmed it, but I've read that a silicon chip, like a modern CPU, is actually the hottest substance per square inch known to man.
That is ridiculous.
Yeah, like hotter than the surface of the sun per square inch, because they're so tiny. So, I think this is cool, though. I think it's going to pave the way for the future. You know, I don't know if everyone remembers, probably about, six, 8 years ago, they switched from aluminum to copper on the interconnects in a CPU. And that, you know, that was like one big leap, because then they could make the wires even thinner and drop the voltage lower, and all those sort of things allow faster and faster processors. On the surface, everybody thinks, oh, you just crank the gigahertz up and it gets faster.
Of course, just crank it up.
Yeah, turn up my gigahertz.
How hard is this?
Yeah, exactly. But it's difficult. So this may be the next big thing. I mean, it's probably 10 years out till it's commercially viable, but it's cool.
I wonder if Moore's Law will hold off for 10 years.
Well, it's going to be pretty hard for it to do that now. And the reason is they just put more chips on the CPU.
Right, 50-core processor.
Right. So at that point, you know, the thing is really we have like a long way to go in multi-threaded programming. And
pretty much nothing. I mean, there are some, but for the most part, nothing can take advantage of A, multi-threading, and B, multi-processors.
Yeah. There's actually a good video about modern multi-threading and software. And I think the really reality of it is there's still a lot of research to be done, but there's never going to be an easy solution to taking serialized problems and trying to multi-thread them. So, I guess that potential to maintain Moore's Law is there in the chip, but if the software can't take advantage of it, then it's really lost.
Right. So that is a pretty good point, you know, for those of you out there buying new computers that, you know, you have the choice between an 8-core processor or a 4-core processor. You know, what are you really getting out of that?
Yeah. Unless you're running many, many simultaneous things independent of one another, like, you know, on a server with multiple connections. It's not much of much use. But the thing to remember about Moore's Law, too, is it's not about speed. It's his law was really about transistor count. It's just that the transistor count would double on the processor because we're able to shrink the size of the transistors.
All right. Do you know what we're at now? Is it 90 nanometer, 45?
Oh, smaller. I think the next round is Intel processors are going to be 0.22 or 0.3.
Oh, really? I was going to say in the 30s somewhere.
It's I think 0.35 and 0.22 are like on the horizon.
Nice.
So I know, and 0.45 is all everywhere.
Yeah, so lots of fast processors.
Yep.
So we talked about DNS before, and I think we might have briefly mentioned that the DNS root zones are now signed. They use DNSSEC, DNS security. So all of your, if you don't know what DNS is, you know, you type into your browser, google.com. Well, the internet doesn't know what google.com is. And the internet only knows numbers, kind of like a phone number to a person or a social security number to a person, something like that.
Yeah, try telling your phone, call Kevin Salonka. Actually, wait, mine does do that.
Okay, well, forget about voice activation.
Damn it.
So 10 years ago, pick up a landline phone and say, call Kevin Salonka. Your phone is going to do absolutely nothing. That's kind of what the internet is like. It has no clue. So these DNS servers take human language, google.com, and translate it into the numbers or the, you know, think of it as your street address. Translates it into the address of Google's webpage so you can view it. Now, there have been a lot of hacks going on that people can, you know, sniff your traffic. They can redirect your traffic, send you to malicious pages, because just like those old SCADA systems we were talking about, DNS never had any security. It was just a wide open thing. If you knew how to take advantage of it, you could. Well, now you can't, at least until somebody finds a way to break DNSSEC, because it's all encrypted. And one cool feature of DNSSEC is that if it detects a bunch of a malicious activity, DNSSEC can sever the connections between all of the root DNS servers, which will basically make most of the internet unviewable. You know, it'll physically break the internet. You know, your local internet might work. Like if you have your own company, that'll work because you have your own DNS server.
Probably places you've been to would be cached.
Because they're cached, right?
Yeah, the cache, I think, but there's an age out on the cache. And
yeah, so if you've never been to, you know, Newegg, and you try to go to Newegg again, you know, it's not going to be able to do that because those servers have died. DNSSEC killed the connection, so it's not going to be able to figure out what the address is. And when that happens, we have just found out a couple days ago that the internet now has 7 keymasters. Cue Ghostbuster music.
Oh, yeah. I'm actually the gatekeeper.
Oh, you're the gatekeeper.
Yeah.
I wish I was one of the keymasters.
No, you don't.
I probably could have been, because there was some sort of form that you had to fill out. You could have applied to become a keymaster. I didn't know about it. I mean, they probably would have told me, no, you're an idiot, but I could have at least applied for it.
Do you, like, get the hunchback when you apply for it?
Yes.
Oh, it's
yes.
Part of the rules.
Yeah, you get that. Okay. But basically, if DNSSEC was to sever the connections between all the root DNS servers, these 7 people have to come together with their part of the DNSSEC key, the encryption key, put it all back together so that the DNS servers can get back online.
Gee, that's a little scary.
That's scary, but how cool is that?
It's kind of cool, but I mean, like, what happens if one of them dies or gets kidnapped or...
Yeah, it's actually...
This sounds like a ransom situation. Like, break the DNS servers, like...
And then hold them hostage.
And hold just one of them hostage.
Well, I shouldn't... I was an idiot. It's not all 7. You only need a certain number of the 7.
Okay.
It's like only 4 of the 7 or 5 of
and
the 7.
And that number is only known by 12 people.
Right. Sounds like a Dan Brown novel. But anyways, yeah, that'd be a good thing for ransom.
Yep, one key to rule them all.
Right. Hold 3 of them hostage so that they can't, you know, they're only one short, they can't get the internet back up
and
running.
This sounds like the beginning of, like, Lord of the Rings. Somehow. Well, at least the part where they meet in that mythical city.
Okay, for those of you out there listening, do not take that idea. I'm going to start writing a book right now. I'm going to get a patent on it. So don't take this idea.
I call prior art. You can license it from me, though.
Oh, really? How much?
$170 billion.
I don't have that much money.
Well, just hack one of those ATMs.
Ooh, awesome. See, this is why you need to listen to this show. So many good ideas. All right, so moving on, getting away from black hat and security things. This is kind of a big boo-boo. We hear about big boo-boos all the time. This big boo-boo came from Valve. Valve, they are the creators of such games like the Orange Box and all the games that come in the Orange Box, like Half-Life, Portal, Team Fortress. They also make Steam. If you've ever played games via Steam, which is basically a way to download a game over the internet instead of having to buy the CD or DVD. And they had a boo-boo. Did you hear about this? Any of your friends start complaining about this?
No, I have no friends.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No.
Okay, so anyways... basically, with all these online game playing things...
Oh, wait, no friends that play games.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. I was about ready to hug you, I mean this.
No, please don't.
So with all of these online game playing things, they are able to track whether you're cheating, whether you're installing mods to give you more power, you know, whatever you're doing in the game, basically any way to cheat. And Steam is no... It does the same thing. And they basically thought that, you know, what was the number? About 12,000 people were cheating, and
cheaters.
When they do this, they don't just say, "Hey, you're cheating. Please stop." They just ban your account and you're done forever. I don't play any games on Steam, but I can imagine, you know, investing hours and hours into a game, and then all of a sudden, bam,
you're banned,
gone.
Yeah, and people spend money on these games.
Oh yeah.
Well, actually, I don't know if. Maybe
not Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2,
yeah,
which is what
not.
This was about, but yeah. Games like World of Warcraft where you can buy gold and buy things.
Yeah.
I mean, holy crap. But 12,000 people, and yeah, this is a big boo-boo, but they made it better. And they've even given out, I forget what they gave out. They gave out free copies of Left 4 Dead 2 to everybody who was banned.
That's kind of nice, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know anybody.
And you can give one to a friend. That's really, it's like, oh, you're my friend. Here's a copy of Left 4 Dead 2.
Right. How nice is that?
Yeah.
So I guess they are assuming that you have friends.
Yeah, that's a pretty big assumption in this industry.
That's true. Although I just read an article today that apparently gamers have way more friends and have way more sexual activity than non-gamers do.
Interesting.
Yeah, some study. I'm going to have to start playing games. All right, one more. One more article talking about security before we move on to some new topics. And this one, I pretty much just want... I want your opinion, Ryan, on what you think of this. The White House proposal...
Sucks.
Yes, sucks. ...would ease the FBI's access to records of internet activity. So not the content, so they're not going to be reading your email, but it gives law enforcement ways to get your search history, dates and times that you sent emails. Basically, they can get these things already, you know, with subpoenas and with lots and lots of judges' signatures. But now, you know, if the FBI needs it, there's a proposal out there that they can just go get it. Pretty much no questions asked.
Yeah, I think there should always be a judge involved in this stuff. I don't care what it is, honestly. I just don't. I mean, I think we all need to be protected, and, you know, there's some role that the government plays in making sure we're not, like, taken hostage by terrorists and that sort of stuff. But it's not like it takes... if they need to grease the skids in the system and so that the judges can take a look at this stuff, then they need to do that. Like, not just bypass the whole court system.
Yeah, and is this even bad, though? You know, this article kind of compares it to phone records. You know, they can pretty much grab those with ease. You know,
they don't need a judge for phone records?
Oh, I believe they do, but it's not as hard as it was to get records from the internet.
Oh.
So, I mean, yeah, is this too much Big Brother? Is it enough?
To be quite honest, the fact that the government can force any private entity to, like, turn over... I guess part of it is that... Part of it's, like, the... Like, getting the cooperation, and the other part is just being able to, like, circumvent somebody's civil liberties. I really think the judge is about circumventing, you know, you're circumventing somebody's civil liberties, you know, and if you think that privacy is a liberty that you are entitled.
Right, right. Yeah. Personally, I don't see a problem with it. You know, I'm a communist in this area.
We're not doing anything wrong.
You have nothing to worry about.
Yeah, well, no, I'm not like that.
See, I am, because, I mean, sure, I've known ever since that I've had the internet that every webpage I surf, every click that I make, you know, can be taken by the police or FBI or CIA. The NSA already does have all of that. They take it every day. You know, so I know this is happening. Everybody else should know this is happening. So, yeah. So I guess we have a little differing opinions here. I don't see it as a big deal. You don't like it so much.
No, I don't.
I want to hear you guys' comments on that. So, you know, comments wherever you see this on my website, on Facebook, on Twitter, wherever you see the posting about this episode. I want to hear what you guys say to see how many people out there don't want the Big Brother syndrome, kind of like England and the UK and Europe does, you know, with all of their CCTV cameras. Okay, so we have a couple social networking stories. The first two kind of go together, and they're about Facebook. We haven't talked about Facebook in a while. We kind of mentioned it randomly a past couple times.
Yeah, mainly just about Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah. So this is not about him, thankfully.
We had to mention his name, though.
Yes, Mark Zuckerberg.
It's fun to say.
@Zuck on Twitter.
Really?
Yes. Oh. He doesn't answer anything, but you can send him stuff. I've tried. He doesn't talk to me. But Facebook quietly added, they didn't tell anybody, but you used to have a deactivate account option, which would basically make your profile unavailable, but now they have a delete account. So the question now is this delete the account and everything that you've posted, or is this like delete the account, remove it from their backups, remove it from their servers, from their search history? You know, is it just a delete from view, or is it a delete from existence? I don't know that anybody knows.
Yeah, they said, someone mentioned, it'd be surprising that they'd be willing to give up the information.
Yeah, because they try to get into the search industry. They're really big, and that is money to them.
I like one of the comments under this story from Slashdot. Somebody says, where's the Slashdot's delete account button?
Yeah, there are very few sites that I use that I've even seen a delete account button.
I think this is something that I would see as a good first move on Facebook's part, and I'd like to see more sites have this.
I totally agree.
Like, complete wipe. I mean, no trace of your data on their systems anymore.
Yeah, you delete your account, you go to Google a week later once they've cleared their cache and search for yourself, and it does not show up.
Right. Other than what might be legally required to maintain for tax purposes or something like that. But, you know, if it was like a website that had, like, you know, money, financial transactions or something. But I'd like to see that. The interesting thing is I could have swore that I saw that delete account option in prior years. in there.
Maybe they did have it and they took it away. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a while. Like, I was, you know, nosing through the privacy settings once upon a time a while ago when they made some random change. And I thought I saw it in there, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, and those privacy settings aren't the best things to look at. So, you know, who knows if you did see it or where it's at, you know, when you did see it. I can't find anything in those privacy settings. But moving on to the next story, if you think that the delete account option will keep your information out of the public eye, you're wrong, because one security researcher went through and basically lifted up all of the public-facing information from every profile that he could on Facebook, over 100 million profiles, compiled it all together into a spreadsheet or some other easily, I forget exactly what type of file, but compiled it all together into an easily readable file. I think he did mention a spreadsheet, and put it up on BitTorrent. And the funny thing is, I'm going to read you some names of some of the companies that have downloaded these Facebook profiles from BitTorrent. Now, you know, should say, just like the article here on Gizmodo says, that doesn't mean that these companies authorize this download. That just means that somebody from this IP address that belongs to these companies downloaded it. They might have did it on their own. Their company probably doesn't know about it. But here are some companies who downloaded all of this information from Facebook. Apple?
That's it, just Apple.
Just Apple. They are the only ones on this list.
No, I'm kidding.
The BBC, Boeing, Cisco, Disney, HP, IBM, Intel, Lockheed Martin, Motorola, Northrop Grumman, Oracle, Sega. I didn't even know they were around anymore. Turner Broadcasting System, TBS, the United Nations, Vodafone, Xerox. I mean, there are a lot more. The United States Postal Service? Come on.
Yeah.
So people who at least work for all of these companies have downloaded this information. Now, it's not illegal because it is public information. Are you concerned that your information might be part of this 100 million?
Well, I put a pretty tight lid on my public-facing information. I don't think that it would be of much use.
Yeah.
I remember reading something about someone who had gathered the public-facing information to make a network of people based on where they work and schools.
Yeah, that was some time ago. I remember that.
Yeah, so that if that information's in there, I mean, that type of everybody's profile, if there's even just the slightest bit of public-facing information with regard to where you work or where you went to school, or could be used, maybe not against you, but against an entity to understand how
big picture together.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, that's kind of maybe a little scary, but
yeah. And like the guy said, you know, there's nothing illegal about it. It's kind of like, you know, paging through the phone book, finding people's names, phone numbers, and addresses. You know, the information is all there and it's all legal. It's just before the internet, there's never been a way to collect all of this information and pass it on to the world so quickly. So that's what makes this dangerous. You know, we've always had this problem with the phone book, but not to this scale. So, just, you know, to mention again, go through the privacy settings on Facebook. If you're worried about people having your information, you can lock it down if you want to. And while we're still talking about social networking, we have an article here about Digg.
Oh, yeah. So apparently, DiggNation or Digg.com.
Yes, DiggNation.
Yes. Whoops. I'm so like out of it. Yeah, Digg.com has shut down their new user registration.
And we know what that means.
Yeah, there's a new Digg coming, apparently.
Did you get in on the beta?
No, I didn't.
I did.
Oh, so you know about this.
Yes.
Yeah, I was like, what? What's that about? Although I haven't been keeping up with it, so.
I mean, maybe it's good for some people, but you go ahead and talk about what you want to talk about, then I'll give you my idea of what I think.
Well, because I haven't seen it, and I didn't even know there was a beta, I feel pretty uninformed on this topic. But I just thought it was interesting that, you know, that they kind of announced, hey, and I'm not real sure like why they're not accepting new registrations. I'm guessing they want to, like, I don't know, limit the amount of work they have to do in translating accounts over.
Yeah, I don't know. They mentioned about the beta, or I guess they're calling it the alpha or pre-alpha, whatever it is. I heard it on Digg Nation or some other podcast that Kevin Rose is on. He's like, Oh, I think he was on Twit. Mm. Yeah, he unveiled it on Twit live a couple Sundays ago, and it was like, if you're listening to this in the next hour, go sign up and we will give you access to the beta. I'm like, holy crap, I gotta go. So I got it, and it's pretty much Twitter.
Twitter. Dig with Twitter.
It's dig with a Twitter-esque feel.
So you can post your own things, your own feed of news stories?
Yes, you can post your own things. You can follow stories that other people post. So it's kind of just like Twitter, except less about what you had for lunch and more about articles that you've read on the internet.
Mm. I mean, is the layout a lot different?
It looks very similar. You know,
you have to sign an NDA? Are you violating an NDA right now?
No.
Okay.
Dude, do you know how bad it was to sign up? I entered my email. I clicked submit. They sent me a thing. I entered a password. Done. Oh, okay. There was like nothing on the registration page.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was really surprised.
Well, it's kind of interesting. I just thought it's, you know, Digg's a pretty big social deal. And
yeah, I mean, for a lot of people, that might even be a lot better than the way Digg is now. Because now you just see news articles from the world. And maybe you don't care about what the world has to say.
Yeah, I hate the world.
Seriously, they suck.
I only care about me.
I only care about Ryan, too. So, yeah, look out for the new Digg in the coming... I don't know when it's coming. So maybe the coming days, maybe the coming weeks. But if you like hearing news articles from your friends and not from random people, you will definitely like the new Digg. So I'm going to let Ryan take over the next couple stories of the show, talking about some tablet computers.
Yeah. So first off, there's a there's a class action suit that got organized to with regards to the iPad and its overheating. There's some complaints that the iPad overheats in direct sunlight, and this sort of goes against one of its key marketing aspects.
Doesn't everything overheat in direct sunlight?
Well, I have to say, I've never had my like cell phone or, and I use a lot of equipment in direct sunlight that seems to fare pretty well. But I think that, you know, I think the obvious reason this happens is that the entire screen on that on the iPad is black. So it probably is just a heat magnet. That said, I'm not sure that you can sue them for this, but I will say this. I have experienced this. A friend of mine has an iPad, and we were using it with the band that I run sound for, and it actually overheated.
That sucks.
Yeah, we were outside down at the band shell. The band shell, there's a band shell here in Johnstown that's for anyone out of town listening, which I don't know if there is or not. But
I think there might be.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, I'm not trying to sell you short or anything. But anyway, we were down there doing a show, and it was in the evening. It was like 5 to 7 under a tent, but the sun was coming into the tent a little bit. And sure enough, I went to pick it up, and it had this yellow triangle.
Oh, it had the warning logo.
Yeah, yellow triangle. It said, you know, hey, your iPad is too hot. Let it cool down. I'm like, you guys are so self-involved. You think you're so hot. No, it wouldn't work. It wouldn't do anything. You couldn't do anything with it.
Just had to let it cool down.
Yeah, so I stuck it in the shade, and within a couple minutes, it was back. But it was annoying because we had some music on it that we wanted to play back, and I couldn't do it.
During the breaks?
Yeah. And I've had an iPod for, I don't know.
Since iPods came out?
Yeah. Well, not the first gen, maybe like the second or third gen. And I've never had one overheat. I've had them break, but I've never had them overheat. I've never had a phone overheat. And we have, you know, even there's a lot of electronic equipment in that band. We are always playing outside, and it's never overheated.
Yeah, I will tell you that Apple products, all of them, do get hot. Yeah. My laptop heats up my legs pretty good. Mm-hmm. I can feel whenever I'm watching a lot of video on my iPhone, the back of it gets hot.
Yeah. Well, there a lot of times they're about fanless cooling, and I don't know if are there fans in it in that.
No. Oh yeah.
Oh, there are.
You can hear them turn on.
Oh, okay. But I mean, they try to use the case as a big part of like the heat sink in terms of getting rid of the heat. But
yeah. And my problem is I have the MacBook Pros have two video cards, the onboard and the discrete. Mm-hmm. And I always have it on the discrete because it's more horsepower.
Yeah.
So, of course, a lot more heat that way.
Yeah. So, I just thought it was interesting. You know, beware.
And I kind of agree with you that you really can't sue them for something getting hot.
Well,
if you get burned.
Maybe yes. Truth in advertising. Like, it's weird. In other countries, there's a bit, like in the UK, there's a much stricter
Yeah, we need their rules.
Yeah, they're very strict with advertising. They've made Apple change their advertising several times because they've, like, back in the run of the original iPhone commercials, I think it was the first iPhone 3G, maybe. I'm not sure, but it had Wi-Fi, and they demonstrated a lot of the apps loading over Wi-Fi and saying, oh, it's super fast on 3G, when really it couldn't even approach those speeds.
Yeah, I think that was... Wasn't that just for their commercials where, you know, they show you how you can do things, open up app, close an app, surf the net,
yep.
And people tried to do it and recorded themselves on YouTube, and they're like, there is no way you can do this.
Yeah, it had that goofy Apple music behind it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Da, 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 da.
Yeah, yeah, that's it, actually.
I'm sorry, I probably just lost everybody right there.
Yeah, everyone just turned off the iPod, or the podcast.
Crap.
Thanks. We need cricket sounds. So anyway, you know, beware, I guess, but maybe join the class action if you've had this happen, and maybe you'll get some cash out of it.
Yeah, why not?
The next, I guess, tablet story is RIM's supposed entry into the tablet arena with what they're calling the Black Pad.
The Black Pad.
I think the name is horrible.
I agree.
I saw this story on two places. It was here on Ars, and I think it was there was an early rumor on Engadget, and they mentioned the Black Pad.
I can just see somebody taking the song Blackbird and rewriting the lyrics for Black Pad.
Black Pad. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's interesting that they're trying this. I don't understand why RIM would want to get into this market though, because I think the Storm, while it had some neat technology, it was really rough around the edges. The Storm 2 is a bit better, but still not awesome.
And that's the closest thing they have to a tablet-style device.
Yeah,
with a touchscreen.
Touchscreen, similar to an iPhone. I think they need to like nail it on the phone arena first with this touchscreen, unless they have some whole new take on the tablet, you know? And maybe they do.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, they're in a really poor position right now as far as cell phones go, and that's always been their money maker.
Well, they're still the number one in the United States.
Okay,
I mean,
so
let's not cut them short. They're a big company, but they have been losing market share,
right? And especially with consumers, they're huge in enterprise, but as far as consumers go, more consumers own Android and iPhones than they do Blackberries.
Yeah. So,
I think that personally, they need to pick one thing and nail it.
Yeah.
And I think going after phones and tablets is a bad idea.
I mean, some people say, hey, they've already nailed it, you know, back in the days with the early Blackberries and stuff like that. But in jumping into this arena, I don't know. I mean,
yeah, what's the point? What are they gaining from this, really? The tablet arena is not big.
No, it's not. I mean, the market isn't huge yet. They have a name. I mean, people know what a BlackBerry is. So maybe it'll be, and the thing is though, people associate BlackBerry with messaging, and I don't see a tablet being a messaging thing. Who knows though? This could be way off. Like, these are just rumors right now, and maybe this is like an enterprise type thing,
right?
To maybe manage BlackBerries or manage a BlackBerry server, or
yeah, that could be.
You know, who knows what
we might not even see it.
Right. It's hard to say with the rumor, like, you know, they said that Ars Technica, the article that where this is at, they mentioned that there's two sources that confirmed this, one of them being Bloomberg, and I don't know what the other one was.
Well, what was that thing that Bloomberg, quote-unquote, confirmed before that we talked about that was just a bunch of crap?
That was something with the iPhone.
Yeah.
Oh, the Verizon iPhone.
Oh, yeah.
But the thing is, for them to say that, they probably can say it, because eventually, once LTE rolls out, they might actually get one.
Well, of course. I mean,
so it's like, oh, you know, cars will fly someday.
I'm going to have an Android as a maid.
You quote me on that. Cars will fly someday.
Hey,
I don't know when.
It's after the year 2000. Where's my flying car? Mm-hmm. Come on. Yeah. So
who knows? Maybe they'll offer up some cool competition. If I would some advice to BlackBerry, don't make it black and make sure it works in direct sunlight.
No overheating. Yeah, and who knows? You know, maybe this will be exactly what Apple did to phones. Maybe they will just come out, nail it, and everybody else will be like, "Holy crap, we got to catch up now."
Yeah, I mean, there may be some room for improvement. Everybody, there was a lot of criticism around the iPad when it first came out, even though it's popular.
Yeah, it's popular, but people want a computer. They don't want a single function style device.
Yeah.
All right, so the normal ending section of our show is on mobile phones. We got a bunch of articles about mobile phones, some from Black Hat, some not. This first one is more of a mobile phone slash vehicle story. So we mentioned before, you know, I went on a rant. I'm sure y'all remember that. Ooh, I just said y'all. Wow, I've never done that on the show.
But, falling into your dialect.
I really am. Western Pennsylvania.
Kevin's actually from down south.
I really am. But GM now has an app for the iPhone that lets your phone connect to the OnStar system in your vehicle. And you can pretty much do everything that you can have OnStar do by calling them, such as unlock your car, lock your car, start your car, hit the panic button. The reason I picked this article is because this is one step in the direction that I did not want any of this to go. You know, as I said before in my rant on, you know, OnStar and internet in vehicles, I'm fine with internet in like a head unit of a vehicle that does not have access to my brakes or my engine or anything critical. But now OnStar has access to that stuff, and now your freaking phone has access to that stuff. Mm. How crazy is this?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much control you really have. And it's really only going to be what they expose in the API.
Or what somebody can hack through the API if they're not good at it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I'm worried about. I'm not worried about them giving a button that is called a stop engine, you know, because they're obviously not going to do that.
Yeah. I tell you what would be cool, though. Does anybody remember the, it's the second or the third Bond movie with Pierce Brosnan? And he gets his new BMW, and Q hands him some kind of like handheld device with a touchscreen. And it can start the car, and you can drive it with like motions on the touchscreen.
I wanted that about 10 years ago.
If they enabled that, I would buy an iPhone and whatever GM vehicle has it.
Right, doesn't matter what the car is.
I want a remote control big car. That would be awesome.
I have always wanted, and the reason I wanted this is because, you know, at the companies I worked for, I would always get in and the parking lot would be full, so I'd be at the end of the parking lot and it would be the middle of winter or it was raining and I'd have to walk the whole way out there. I've always wanted to like start my car, drive it up under the awning so I can just walk out and get in.
Yeah, that would be kick butt, especially in these cold weather areas.
Yes. So, yeah, I'm not saying this isn't cool. This is amazing, and it's really cool that they give you that control on your phone now, but I'm still really, really scared about what could happen now that control to your vehicle's critical systems is in the palm of your hand when you're not in the car.
Just think how, like, fanciful this stuff seemed when, you know, Knight Rider came out.
Oh,
and,
man.
Like, in the cars now, they probably could be like Knight Rider, save the missiles. Was there missiles in Knight Rider?
I don't know, but I want them.
Yeah.
Why don't we have missiles in our car? Oh, man. All right, so now I'm sure everybody has had this problem at one point in time. You pull out your phone, there's something awesome going on. You're like, oh, crap, I got to take a picture. You snap the picture, you look at the picture, and it's all blurry. And there is nothing you can do about it. Your hand was perfectly steady. You know, it doesn't matter. It's just blurry. Well, researchers at Microsoft have found a way to unblur images. And they've done this now in a very breadboard-style way with an SLR camera. And they've done it through the use of accelerometers and gyros. And the cool thing that they pointed out, everything that phones of today already have.
Hmm. Yeah.
So all this code, smartphones like, you know, the iPhone
definitely
phones.
Has this. I don't know if all like the Blackberries would have all these sensors. But.
Yeah, so any phone that has like a bunch of gyros, a bunch of accelerometers, things like that, all of this research from Microsoft can just work on your phone. And it's really cool. They give you some images of what they detect. So they detect on all the axes how you rotated your phone when you hit the shutter button based on the gyros and the accelerometer. They do some sort of magic. And they put it back together. Now, it's not a perfect image. It's still barely, barely blurry, but you really can't tell unless you're looking for it. Did you look at some of these sample images?
Yeah, I was looking at this before I came down. It's pretty cool. The one with the Coke cans is, you know, with the writing is really, really telling.
Yeah, all the small writing is actually readable.
Yeah. Now, I mean, I can't tell because I don't we don't have an original picture of it unblurry, but we just have what they unblurred.
Well, if you isn't yours animating?
Yeah. No. What I'm saying is we don't have an original picture that was not blurry. Like, so what I was saying is it's a little bit hard to tell.
I gotcha.
What type of artifacting it puts in place. But if anyone's ever used the sharpening tool, there's a lot of image editors have a sharpening tool. It'll kind of like refine some edges. I can see, at least in the Kokan one, a little bit of evidence of that, like some highlights on the lettering.
Yeah, I forget what they call a haloing or something.
Yeah, haloing. It could just be the lighting, but and it's still great. I mean, this is cool. I mean, I'm not trying to knock the technology, but it's really, really interesting. The only thing, it's nice that they have this technology, but this is very similar to the VR the vibration reduction and image
stabilization.
Yeah.
And they mentioned that in the PDF.
Yeah, it's very similar to that. Now, the image stabilization and VR from Canon and Nikon, respectively, they actually have a lens that's inside of the bigger lens that actually moves.
Yeah, it's like a dampener style lens.
Yeah, and it helps keep the focal plane centered. And then some other companies like Pentax use their focal plane, their actual sensor is on little vibrating, not vibrating, but like
so
movable.
They put it in the sensor and not in the lens.
Yeah, which is kind of cool because then you can use your old lens and still get VR. But it's not supposedly not as good. But anyway, the point is that it's similar to those technologies, and that the technology really only helps shaky hands. And shaky hands are really only a problem if you're shooting in low light.
And unfortunately, that's the case for most cell phone pictures.
Yeah, you're right. So it's kind of a tripod replacement.
Yeah, because who carries around a tripod,
right,
if you're going to the bar?
Especially for your cell phone.
Right.
So now the other thing is, as sensors get better, low light sensors may achieve acceptable quality, and this will probably negate the need for this because the nice thing is it's not really a moving target. It's not really a moving target. To get unblurry images, you really just have to hit a certain frame rate, basically, or shutter speed. And once you do, it doesn't matter. So if the sensor's sensitive enough, you know, I don't know if anyone's familiar with the ISO setting on their camera or ISO. That defines how sensitive the sensor is to light. Most cameras have something in the neighborhood of like 200 to, the better cameras are 3200 or 6400.
Yeah, there's some Nikon that goes up like 160,000 or something.
Yeah, there's a couple that get pretty high. The higher you go, the more noise there is, but they're getting better and better every year. So, you know, in 10 years, it may just be moot, even in a camera phone.
Yeah, I'm going to make a prediction that within the next year, we will see this software in all smartphones. I mean, this just seems like a no-brainer.
Yeah.
They've already figured it out. It already works on hardware that most, if not all, smartphones have or will have soon.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking forward to this because I take a lot of pictures with my phone. You know, to quote Alex Lindsay, the best camera is the one you have with you.
Yeah.
So if there's something you need to take a picture of, you don't always have to bring around your SLR. Just take the picture to save the memory.
Yeah.
Yep. Cool. Okay. So really, really cool announcement. And that is the FCC gives the thumbs up to the first LTE phone for use.
Woohoo!
Now, this isn't for purchase. Like, you can't actually go out and buy this. But they've approved it for sale. It's not for sale yet, but it will be available through Metro PCS. And basically, they will be used on Verizon's quote-unquote in-testing LTE network. They say in-testing because very few cities actually have LTE towers and can handle this. But sooner or later, possibly January is the rumor for... that was the rumor for Verizon's iPhone. So I don't know when this is going to come out. This summer was in quotes in the article. So hopefully... I mean, summer's almost over.
Yeah, well, so, we're halfway there.
Well, I mean, end of this month until fall hits, maybe another month.
The end of September is... Or the end of summer is September 23rd.
Is it really?
Yeah.
I hate those solstice days.
No, it's the equinox.
Whatever.
Dude.
I don't know when this stuff happens. I just know that it gets cold around here really quickly.
That's not true. September's beautiful.
So either way, by the end of September, we should see the first LTE phone.
Yeah, it'd be awesome.
Did they say what it was?
Samsung.
The SCH-R900.
Yeah, I used to have an SCH-I760, which I love the phones. I loved Samsung's layout. The phone was great, but it ran Windows Mobile, and it was it had some bugs with it, and it was slow. There was just different memory leaks, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that seems to be the case.
I hate when my memory's leaking all over the place.
Oh, dude, I know. My memory leaks all the time.
Yeah, it's not good.
Okay, so moving right along. We don't want to go ridiculously long this episode, but another Black Hat story. And this one, we kind of mentioned last week whenever we talked about the Kraken program that has been released to snoop on GSM calls. And I basically said that makes it really easy. And, you know, Ryan brought up the good point that it's not really going to be that easy because it's just, you know, probably just one type of GSM and it's not as bad as I was making it out to be. Well, since Black Hat last week, it turns out that it is that bad because this guy demoed it at Black Hat, showed, you know, how one-clicky it was, you know, how easy it was. So I guess now we have to get worried. Now, the way he did this, and it's really cool, is that he really didn't have to, quote-unquote, hack GSM. What he did with this software was he made a fake GSM tower, quote-unquote, tower, from his computer, and whenever anybody in vicinity made a call, that tower was the closest and the strongest, so they called his tower, and he basically played man in the middle and snooped on all of their data. So, yeah, I'm worried now, because now this is getting easy.
Yeah.
And especially if it happened at a big conference, that means a lot of people know about it. So, are you worried now?
No, I don't have a GSM phone.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
You're not on AT&T or T-Mobile.
Yeah, another reason for using proprietary technology.
That's true. Wait, I use proprietary technology. It's just on. Yeah, so if you're interested in this, you know, give them a couple weeks and head on over to the Black Hat website and the DEF CON website. They post the videos of most, if not all, of their briefings. Their, not the training. The training you have to pay for, but all of the speeches, all of the demos, things like that. So chances are you're going to be able to see the guy do this in the coming weeks whenever they post the video. Or if nothing else, you'll at least be able to get like the PDF of his slides.
Is it a little ironic that we talk about security on the show and then we say, oh yeah, go to the Black Hat website where all the hackers hang out.
Well,
you can go there, folks, but don't blame us if the FBI comes a knocking.
I have downloaded so much from the Black Hat and DEF CON website, so many gigs upon gigs of videos. I would have been in jail by now if there was anything wrong with it. Probably.
Yeah. But spying on Kevin.
But I use Linux and Mac, so I don't get viruses. So anyways, a new study came out, and it shows that 53% of all cell phone subscribers are data users, which is a jump from 42% of last year. And the cool thing, I mean, obviously, we all figured this out. You know, we didn't need a study to point this out. But what the study did show, and it's going to be a little startling to some people, is that, is that the iPhone is not the biggest. People with not iPhones use more data than iPhone users.
Maybe because that's where all the real work gets done.
That might be.
Yeah.
They say the average Verizon smartphone user uses 428 megabytes a month compared with 338 megabytes a month for an iPhone user. Now, that's obviously not me because I'm generally over 2 gigs every month, but yeah, that was average, and that kind of surprised me.
It's crazy. I find that, like, they say the average Verizon smartphone owner, it's so hard to believe because, like, I've had a smartphone for a long time, and I don't think I've ever topped, like, 200 or 250. I guess I just don't use it that much.
Yeah, your smartphone isn't really it doesn't have a big screen.
No.
Compared to like the Androids or the Storm. So maybe these numbers all come from users that, you know, download video because their entire device is a screen.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah, so I just thought that was kind of cool. Just wanted to put it out there. And this is kind of a poke on AT&T that, hey, it's not us iPhone users crushing your network because other users use more than us. Yeah. So anyways, moving on. I won't make fun of AT&T anymore. I believe you had this next article about Microsoft.
Yeah, I posted this one. There's an article here written by Peter Bright on Ars Technica, and he's basically going through the whole like scenario of, you know, maybe Microsoft should just skip the third-party phone vendors and go right to building its own hardware.
I agree.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see anything wrong with this idea on the surface. That, you know, I remember watching an interview a while back with Steve Ballmer, and he mentioned that they didn't want to limit themselves, you know, to only having one phone or maybe two phones or something like that. You know, because even like Apple, everyone says, oh, they only make one phone. But they really make a couple phones. You know, there's almost always the previous generation phone that's still for sale alongside the newest. And then there's different sizes. So, you know, maybe they would make a couple phones or something like that. But he said that's not a good idea because it limits yourself, and they think that the market's much bigger than just one style of phone or you know, a small handful, and that they could make, you know, I guess more money because there'd be a larger variety of these phones running. Of course, the challenge is with that is that it's the integration.
Yeah, you become like the Windows operating system where you need to keep drivers for everything.
Yeah.
It makes it a lot harder.
Yeah, so, you know, the author here suggests, you know, maybe they just need to cut out the middleman, build their own phones, kind of like what they did with the Xbox and the Xbox 360, which have been fairly successful, even though they've had a couple hardware glitches.
Yeah, I mean, they've been, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say the most successful gaming platform for hardcore gamers.
As of late, I don't know if they're the most money-making.
I
don't know, profit-wise. But the thing that they talk about in here is about how much money that maybe Microsoft might make per unit. So, you know, in order to be a billion-dollar industry, at say they estimate $30 a pop on the operating system that they might get for like Windows Mobile 6.5, that they would have to sell, you know, millions of units, and it just seemed a little bit far fetched to be able to sell that many units, you know, given even the iPod sells, and it's super successful. But then they credit Apple saying that maybe they make like 200 per unit. And I think their number's a little off because even though Apple makes the hardware, quote unquote, it's really made by somebody else. I don't think Apple actually, you know, they design it, but it's made by somebody else, right?
It's a
Foxconn or something.
Well, here's the thing. This was an argument that I've heard on a couple other shows, is that we don't really know. Does Apple design it and send the specs to Foxconn, and then they go out and find all of the materials and everything and actually do the engineering to make it work? Or does Apple do all of that and just give them a blueprint and say, go do it?
Well, either way, I mean,
like, we know that Foxconn does put them together.
Yeah.
Apple does not assemble them.
Yeah, it's not an Apple factory.
Right.
Maybe Foxconn dedicates a factory to Apple, but it's not.
Well, they do.
Not Apple's factory. But no matter how it works, you know, even if it is really just a, you know, they just manufacture it, or if it's they do all the homework on the actual physical side of it to make the design work, which I doubt's the case. It's probably the former, where they just basically build what Apple specs. But even if that's the case, Foxconn, I don't know what their status is. I'm guessing they're a publicly traded company.
I have no idea.
I mean, they're in China. I don't know how their economy works exactly. But the point is that they're going to want to turn a profit. Okay, so if I'm Intel, for instance, and I make my own chips, like I build a fab and I make my own chips, the factory itself doesn't have to show a profit. The whole corporation does. So if Foxconn, if they want to have any investors, they have to make a profit. So they're going to charge something on top of what the hardware at its minimum, or the work to put the hardware together, would cost. So I think they're overestimating what Apple might make on these phones.
Yeah, because the people at was it iFixit or somewhere, some teardown site, found that the new iPhone is only like $182 in parts, whereas if you were to buy it unlocked, it would cost you $600 or $700.
Mm-hmm.
So what amount of that, you know, goes to parts? What amount of that goes to Foxconn? What amount of that goes to Apple?
Right. Like, maybe Apple makes that much money, but they have to pay for advertising. It's not pure profit. And if you think about Windows Mobile especially, there's like no costs associated for Microsoft. They just develop the OS and they dump it on the, you know, there's probably some integration effort, but they don't really advertise much.
Yeah, you don't see Windows Mobile advertisements.
Yeah, you hardly, I mean, even though there's a more Windows desktop commercials now, they're not even that many, you know.
And I don't even remember seeing Zune commercials.
No.
I mean, were there that many?
No, I mean, Microsoft generally doesn't have to advertise their products too much.
Yeah, people just know Microsoft.
Right. So, I don't know. I think that the disparity there might be a little larger than what they're, you know, leading on. Now, that said, Apple made something like, $3 billion in profit last quarter?
Oh, yeah, it was huge.
So, to make $3 billion, you got to sell a lot of hardware, but they're selling iPhones, iPads. There's a lot of other things going in that mix. I still would imagine that their profit on the PCs is probably much larger. You know,
I don't have any numbers to.
Me either, but I'm just guessing based on usually the miniaturization of technology is what costs more money,
right?
And based on the price of their hardware, I'm guessing the biggest profit margins are seen in their laptop market,
right? In their non-miniature market.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, there's probably a good chunk of profit, and I'm not trying to undercut, you know, the work they've done on the iPhone, but I don't know that it's 200 to 30, like pure profit from that,
right.
You know, from a phone versus just making the OS for it.
Yeah, so bottom line, you think it's a good idea for them to make their own?
I do, though. Yeah, I think they could probably do a better job of it because the Zune is sweet. I mean, it's a nice piece of hardware.
Yeah, it's integrated very well with everything.
You know, maybe they could just work with a couple close partners, you know, rather than have, like, 8 zillion phones out there.
I mentioned it before. What I'm worried about with Android is that it's going to become this like Windows is now. It can run on literally anything, and they're going to have problems because of that.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they could get like Toshiba into it, Samsung, and like maybe, you know, one or two others.
Yeah, you're probably not going to get Motorola because they've seemed to go down the Android path.
Yeah, but I mean, if you can get a couple in there. LG probably would make.
Yeah, LG. They haven't gone down any paths smartphone wise yet, have they?
Yeah, I don't think they have. But then, you know, maybe they'd have better success that way. Because the only thing I'd say to argue against his point about this, if they do go to build one, my guess is they're probably going to work with one of their partners anyways to make the actual hardware. Because that Windows Phone sample device that's been going around that you've seen pictures of, I think that's behind the scenes a Samsung device, right?
I believe so. I think it was mentioned in one of the articles.
Yeah, so.
So, keep talking about Windows Phone 7. We have news that was listed on Engadget that AT&T is claiming that it will be the premier carrier for Windows Phone 7. So I really don't know what to say about this because AT&T is already, you know, crying in their crib that the iPhone is crushing their network.
Yeah.
And now we have something that is, you know, we're led to believe is going to be the next huge thing in mobile phones, Windows Phone 7, and AT&T says it's all on us and only us. What are they doing?
I don't know. I'm a little saddened by this because I really like to see phones on all carriers, but it might be that, and I don't know, I mean, this is just a guess on my part, that some of the phone companies are less than willing to make CDMA devices as LTEs on the horizon.
Right.
That may be. But I've also read that a lot of these phones are going to be dual mode CDMA LTE anyways for years to come. So they have to get into the game on CDMA.
Yeah, and this article also points out that this premier carrier status might be due to a little bit of fighting because we talked last week about Verizon saying, hey, Microsoft, your kin phones suck. Take them back. And now these sources don't think, the source of this article was from PC World. They don't think that Microsoft and Verizon are very good friends anymore. So maybe that's why.
Could be.
Yeah, I guess if you have the choice to make it AT&T or T-Mobile for an exclusive carrier, you're going to pick AT&T because T-Mobile's not really that big.
Yeah.
If that's your only choice. Yeah, I don't know what this is going to do to AT&T's network if it takes off like the news media thinks Windows Phone 7 is going to take off. I'm worried, mostly because my phone is on AT&T and I don't want it to suck any more than it does. So last two stories kind of go together. For a while now, people have thought that Android phones have been unhackable. A, because they're Linux at their core, and B, because, you know, Google has done some magic, whatever they've done. And if you know about the Pwn to Own contest, PWN, the number 2 OWN, it's a contest where they have a bunch of these devices, you know, some laptops, some computers, some phones, and if you can hack it and give yourself remote console root access, you get to keep the device and you get some money too.
Cool.
I believe this happens at the CanSec West conference. I'm pretty sure that's where Pwn to Own happens. Don't quote me on that. But either way, this past year, there was an Android device there, and it came out unscathed. Now, what the article doesn't say is that nobody tried. Mm. They went after things that they knew they could break, like Flash and Windows, and there were some Mac vulnerabilities in there that people, you know, they hacked a Macintosh via Flash in like a second. The dude already had the code up on his personal server. He just went to a web page, hit enter, bam, owned. So, yeah, so for a while now, people have thought that Android was, you know, pretty secure. And it really is. I mean, it's a very secure phone operating system unless you root it, you know, jailbreak it. Mm-hmm. But now, coming out of Black Hat, there are some tools, some software that can let you do that. You know, kind of like we were talking about with GSM, you know, almost one click. Very easily that you could hack an Android phone. And just to mix these last two articles together, if you went to DEF CON, you got a DVD of this. They just handed them out. It cost you $140 to get into DEF CON. No questions asked, no personal information. You just go there, give them $140, you are in the conference, and they give you a DVD with the Android hacking tool. Mm. So what's your opinion on this?
Well, the word unhackable is like, you know, saying
stupid.
It is. It really, I mean, I just don't think there's any such thing as a perfectly secure system.
Well, that the perfectly secure system is the one that nobody can touch.
Well, does that exist? I mean, that's my whole point.
Well, no, that's what I'm saying. Yeah,
oh, right.
Yeah, I'm agreeing with you.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, no one can touch it.
Yeah, it's one that nobody can touch or use.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, I get you. So I think that, you know, saying unhackable is kind of like silly in any context when it comes to something that has been designed by a fallible human. There's going to be holes.
Right, there are going to be concessions on some things that they have to make.
Right. So I just don't see, I mean, even PGP, it's like the kind of the standard for, doesn't it stand for pretty good protection?
Yeah.
It's like, it's not.
No, pretty good privacy.
Pretty good privacy. So it's like, it's pretty good. It's better than most things. But the thing is like, you know, what do you expect from a computer system versus like normal life? I mean, the bank, people steal money from banks all the time. People break into houses all the time. It's possible to do these things in the real world. Fortresses are, you know, penetrable. So
right back in the day, that's, you know, fight a war, you go break into their castle.
I mean, security is important, but to say that it's not doable is really silly.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess that settles it now. You know, pretty much every smartphone OS has been hacked in some form or another. You know, so nobody can go around saying that one is more secure than the other. People have found ways to do it on every platform. So now it just comes down to, you know, which one do you like?
Mm-hmm.
But any other thoughts on any mobile phones? Anything cool you saw in the past week that you wanted to talk about?
No, not really. I'm going to drive over here. I was thinking, though, just, you know, and this kind of brought it back up in my mind, this article about security. And what we're saying, it's like, I think we have to give a lot of credit and a little bit less, you know, maybe like pointing fingers at these companies when it comes to security. Because think of like every building you've ever been in, there's security measures. There's locks on the doors. There's, you know, thumbprint scanners and keypads and retina scanners and all these different forms of technology. But they're all vulnerable. And, you know, when's the last time you asked Master Lock, oh, did you publish the exploits for your locks and fix them? And it's like, well, they're hardware, but do they replace the locks when they know they're easily defeated? They don't.
And that's true. Do they go around to everybody's house in America?
Yeah.
And replace locks?
They don't, you know. So I'd say count your blessings that these people even bother to fix the software so that it's more secure.
Yeah, that is true. You know, a bunch of locks, door locks nowadays can be circumvented by bump keys. Have you heard of bump keys before?
Mm-mm.
So if you look at a key that goes into a normal door lock, you see all the little pits and valleys. No, the pits and valleys are the same things. I don't know what they call them.
Pits and lands?
Yes.
Just like a DVD or
yes,
CD?
Yes, I believe that's what it is, pits and lands. But either way, you know, some parts are higher than the others.
Mm-hmm.
And those make the tumblers, you know, move up and down to line them up so you can turn the lock. Well, a bump key has all of them at the lowest height possible. And you put the key in 90% of the way, give it a good slap so that it jumps all of the tumblers up, and you try to turn the key and catch them as they fall to make the tumblers line up and turn the key. And it works really well. You know, people can pretty much bypass almost any standard door lock because of that.
Yeah.
You know, they're not going around replacing those locks.
I mean, somebody probably had a patent on the way that lock worked, you know, 100 years ago or 200 years ago. And nobody's like saying, oh, you need to fix your, you know, lock design.
Right. What they're actually saying is, hey, we have this new door lock. It's minimum $140. Go buy it. You know, companies, what is it? Slage? Is that how you pronounce that?
Oh, yeah.
They're one of the bigger makers of door locks. You know, that's what they did. They don't go around replacing people's locks. They just say, hey, we have this new lock that's impenetrable to bump keys.
Yeah.
If you want it, it's $140.
Right.
So, yeah, the software world is quite different that these people actually take the time to give us all of these things for free.
And, yeah, we demand it. I mean, like I said, I think security is important, and you should know your vulnerabilities. But if you don't know that that lock on your door isn't a vulnerability, then you're kind of stupid.
Yeah, do you have a window in your house?
Yeah, I mean, it's like we take for granted these things, you know. I think what's interesting is, just thinking about breaking and entering in general, like breaking and entering into a house versus breaking and entering into a computer system. How much more common do you think it is in the computer world versus the real world? Do you think it's like magnitudes worse, not as bad, equal? And, you know, you don't have to answer that because it's hard to know that.
I mean, I don't want to say common as in a lot of people are doing it, but I do want to say magnitudes worse just because you can affect lots more remotely.
You might be able to, you're right. The accessibility is great.
Yeah, you can't break into a million homes in 5 seconds. But you can
How can we, you know, if it's really that bad, maybe the crimes are worse. You know, maybe breaking and entering into one house is not as bad as breaking and entering 2 million computer systems. So should the penalties be stiffer to deter would-be hackers? You know,
what are the penalties now? You know,
I don't know.
5 years in jail, no internet access?
My guess is that they're, well, maybe, but I guess that a lot of the penalties are just based on real-world penalties, like what it would be like breaking and entering into a bank or something.
Right.
Or so.
Yeah, or if they did try to make them different, do the people really know how to make them different?
Right.
You know?
It's just an interesting little segment we have in the tech world that we don't have in the real world. You know, this whole, I mean, maybe they, you know, maybe we're just not into the whole locksmithing arena and we don't know about their Black Hat conference. But
right. Yeah. And maybe this is something that, you know, happened a long time ago whenever they were making up the rules for the court systems. You know, this whole conversation we're having, and they're like, how do we make up rules for breaking into a house?
Yeah.
We've never had houses before. We had stick huts.
Yeah.
You know, so now it's a whole new conversation. It's the same conversation, but just a new area.
Yeah, I mean, there's even the concept of just unlawful entry, like not even breaking and entering, just
knocking on the door.
And entering without permission. And
right.
The same thing could be said of a computer system. You know, don't go where you shouldn't be.
Yeah, it sounds simple, but so many people do not understand that.
Yeah, so anyway, that was, I guess, Ryan's thought of the day.
We're going to have to make that a new segment on the show. Ryan's Thought of the Day, or Thought of the Week.
Oh, there you go. Thought of the Week.
All right. So that is the end. That is everything we have to talk about on this week's Longcast. If you want to submit an article for us to talk about on next week's Longcast, bookmark it on Delicious and tag it as Slongcast 013. Next week will be episode 13. As always, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. My username is Slongcack. You can find Ryan also on Facebook and Twitter. Username is Ryan Lancey. And I hope everybody has a wonderful Monday night.